What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
The most exciting part of a vacation stay at a home rental? Easy. It's being greeted upon arrival with a rusted lockbox affixed to the underside of a stranger's condo. Yeah, you simply twist knobs, click gears, jiggle it, and then rip it off its moorings, and voila! Your prize is a key to a questionable home rental and maybe tetanus. When you just want to get your vacation started by actually getting into your room, it matters where you stay. At Hilton, we deliver your key right to your phone on the Hilton Honors app. Hilton, for the stay.
Hey, welcome to IKEA, where even this desk is circular.
Huh. How so? Looks pretty rectangular to me.
It's because we're always looking to repair, reuse, and relove our products, like buying back your IKEA items for store credit. Or shop our as-is section for great deals. You can even order free spare parts. Get on the circular path for a more sustainable future.
Still a rectangle.
Get started at ikea-usa.com/circular. Visit ikea-usa.com/circular for as-is information and buyback and resale terms and conditions. Spare parts not available for all products.
Hi, and welcome to New Books in Genocide Studies, a channel on the New Books Network of podcasts. My name is Kelly McFall from Newman University, and I'm the host of the show. My guest today is Ambassador Joyce Leader, author of the new book, From Hope to Horror, Diplomacy and the Making of the Rwandan Genocide. Joyce was Deputy Chief of Mission at the U.S. Embassy in Rwanda from August of 1991 to April 1994, and in her book, she crafts a narrative of the political and diplomatic conflicts that led up to the genocide. She then proceeds to draw lessons from this conflict, lessons that we can apply to future crises. It's a truly fascinating book, one that fills in our picture of a period in Rwanda when peace seemed possible. I'm thrilled to have a chance to talk with the ambassador about her experience. So with that, Joyce, thanks for being with us, and welcome to New Books in Genocide Studies.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
So before we talk about the book, I'd like to just have the listeners get a feel for who you are. How did you decide you wanted to be a diplomat?
Well, I wanted to do something that was international from the time that I was very young, and a friend of mine came back from when her father was a Fulbright scholar teaching in France, and she told me at 6 years old that she dreamed in French, and I was hooked ever since.
And how so in effort?
I was just interested in getting into foreign affairs, and it took me a long time to get there. But I finally decided that I was just going to go and try to get into the Foreign Service, and that would be my way. When I was young, there weren't a lot of avenues to do international affairs, especially for women, and so this was my chance.
Yeah, I'm intrigued by that. What was there something distinctive about your experience as a woman rather than a man? Was it more or less the same experience, do you think? What was that like?
Well, definitely in terms of the Foreign Service, when I went in, the women in the Foreign Service had just had somewhat recently, a few years earlier, filed a suit saying that the application materials were gender imbalanced, let's put it that way. Mm-hmm. And so there weren't that many women in the Foreign Service at that time. And certainly not in the higher echelons. It's of course, it's totally changed now. In fact, when I went in, they had just allowed women who had married to come back in, but at their regular, at their grade that they had left.
And how did you decide you wanted to spend so much of your life in Africa or focused on Africa?
Well, when I was coming out of college, I was looking again for a way to do something international. I was working in New York, and my job was related to a student organization that had to do with the United Nations. And so in the process of all that, I did find that there were some ways to go overseas. And so I went and interviewed with this group in New York, in Boston, And they suggested that I go to Bechuana Land, which is the previous name for Botswana in southern Africa. And I said, well, why couldn't I go to someplace interesting like Pakistan or Uganda or who knows? But anyway, I went back to New York and did a little research and told him that I was fine with Bechuana Land. And I had a marvelous experience for 2 years there and then kind of got locked into a Africanist as I was moving it through my career in the Foreign Service.
And I'm right.
And I had also, before the Foreign Service, I had also done 3 years as a Peace Corps staff in what was then called the Congo. It was Zaire at that time.
And am I right? You worked with refugees, right? Or refugees
when I was
and migrants?
In the Foreign Service, yes, I was interested in refugees. And the first few assignments, they wouldn't let me do that because that wasn't good for your career. So anyway, I finally did get to work with refugees in first in Geneva at the U.S. mission, which is the sort of the center of where the U.S. embassy, where the U.S. diplomatic service links into international refugee activities. And then subsequently, that was mostly when I did that. But then in most of my jobs, I also had to deal with refugee situations.
So I think many of our listeners have a 10,000 feet understanding of what happens in an embassy, but probably don't know much about the day-to-day life of somebody who's a deputy chief of mission. So what's the job description for the job that you did generically in Rwanda? What kind of activities did you do?
Well, I think that this is partly what I tried to convey in is what it was like to be in that position and to be in Rwanda at that time doing that work. But a place like it differs whether you're in a small embassy like I was in Rwanda, which is typical of small countries that don't have much impact on U.S. national security, or in a larger embassy. I mean, it was quite different when I was in Nigeria, where I was like one of three people in a political section. In Rwanda, the political section was merged with the consular section, and it was a junior officer who had that position. So, in fact, we only had really three reporting positions, and the other positions at the embassy were more administrative. So I was... The ambassador took on most of the relations dealing with the political affairs that were going on in the country. I got involved with the civil society that was going on and had to backstop him. So I knew most all of the political figures as well. And then the third person did economic affairs. As well as linking to the military, which I did some of as well, but that was mostly in her portfolio or his portfolio. And I had to also sort of get involved with embassy mission-wide activities. We had the United States Information Service, which at that time took care of the USIS activities and in the country, USIA, and that was mostly journalism and exchange activities with Rwandans and the US. And then also we had the USAID there. We had there were more people, more Americans working for USAID than there were for the embassy, and it was a bigger operation. But we also would continue to link with non-governmental organizations that were American, that were there, and with all the UN organizations that were connected with the kind of work we were doing. UNHCR, the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, was there, UNDP, So there was there were a lot of people that you would get to know in the Rwandan community, in the international community, of course, your colleagues, your diplomatic colleagues as well. So we were always relating to those people, and the job, I was a political officer, and so the job is basically to understand what's going on in the country as it affects American policy, and then to write that down and convey it to Washington, where the policy making process resided. And we would feed into that policy making process through the kinds of reports that we would send back to the country, to the capital, to Washington.
Mm-hmm. So you arrived in Rwanda in the summer of 1991. How much did you know about the country before you arrived, and what kind of impression did you have of the country in the first days and weeks after your arrival?
Interestingly enough, I had been to Rwanda several times, and most of that was in relationship to my work as a Peace Corps Associate Director for Education in Zaire, next door, the large neighbor to the west. And that was because mainly because for 2 years of my time there, I was supervising the Peace Corps volunteers who were teaching in Rwanda. So I would visit periodically, not a lot of times, but I would visit occasionally. And I got to know Rwanda through the attitudes and the information that I got from the volunteers to a large extent. But I also, in working with people who were in Zaire, we had a training site right on the border with Rwanda. And some of those people had experiences and even family in Rwanda. So I sort of got to know it that way, and through the Peace Corps, and then later through refugee affairs, I was sent to Rwanda from my job in Geneva to do some liaison work with Washington when they had an influx of refugees from Burundi, just to sort of help them out a little bit. So I had a little knowledge of it. But when I got to Rwanda, it was quite exciting in the sense that the president had announced that there would be an opening to democratization, to democracy. The government in power had been in charge. It was from the Hutu majority government that had been in the driver's seat for nearly 20 years. They had taken over. They were mostly from the north of Rwanda, and they had taken over in a coup from the previous Hutu majority government that had been in the south. And they were now announcing an opening a year before I got there, announced this opening to democracy, and that there could be. And then just before I got there, they had legalized multiple political parties. And so many people were, you know, getting involved with the political process and joining this party or that party that was reestablishing itself from the days of independence, because the government in charge had been ruling as a one-party state for most of those 20 years after they took over in the coup. So there was a lot of excitement in the air. There were new newspapers were forming to support the democracy process, and particularly the new political parties, which were primarily initially in the opposition to the current government, Hutu opposition to the current government. So you had Hutu on both sides of the coin, those who were going to support the president and those who were against the president. And so there were a lot of human rights organizations forming to insist on respect for human rights and to follow up if there were breaches of that with investigations and reports. So there was an awful lot going on. So and it was very exciting, and I was getting to know, as I got to know people, one of the things that the volunteers said, that it was always so hard to get to know respondents because they were fairly closed, fairly reticent to share much about themselves or the way they were thinking or feeling. And I began to find that you know, wasn't always true, that a lot of Rwandans were very interested to talk about what was going on and to get to know somebody from the American embassy.
One of the really interesting observations you make is, for the first months after you arrived, the peace process, right? Because of course the RPF had invaded a while before you arrived, but the peace process and the democratization process were separate tracks.
Yes. Yes.
I'm intrigued by that. How does that happen?
Well, the way it happened was that as this excitement was going on in the capital and all of this, you know, idea of democratization was the focus of the political activities in the capital. As you say, it was just about exactly the same time that the president announced the opening to democracy, that the RPF, the made up mostly of Tutsi refugees from Uganda, the country to the north, had invaded. But this war, this invasion, this what I call a simmering, it was a simmering conflict that was taking place at the border, was not very much on the minds of people in Rwanda, in the capital. Huh. It was just that little, you know, that was just a little conflict going on up there. And they weren't paying any attention. And this is particularly the impact of that is that the role that the Tutsi, the minority group in Rwanda, and who were the bulwark of this invading group, the Rwandan Patriotic Front, were not part of the equation. Mm. They were not part of the discussion as they were talking about making a multi-party government inside Rwanda. They weren't part of the discussion. The Tutsi inside Rwanda were not organized among themselves. If those who were becoming excited and interested in the opening to democracy were participating in other political parties, primarily one particular political party called the Liberal Party, they did have at least one human rights organization, which was comprised primarily, almost entirely, almost 100%, I would say, of Tutsi, who were looking at it from the Tutsi perspective, as opposed to the Hutu perspective. But the Hutu human rights organizations were actually looking at it from all sides. So the problem, this became a rather significant problem, is that they had no voice in this whole democratization process. That is the Tutsi and the RPF, which may have something to do with why they took up arms and tried to fight their way back and get a seat at the table, which they did. But it was at the Arusha peace talks. So that's when the Tutsi began to have a voice in the democratization process. And that's why they more or less succeeded, or aimed and did succeed, in co-opting the democratization process. Mm. It sort of was taken out of the hands of the Hutu that were negotiating the outcome in Rwanda, in Kigali, in the capital of Rwanda, by among themselves, and it became the centerpiece of the peace talks in Arusha, which was where they were taking place in Tanzania, a country to the east of Rwanda. So the peace talks were taking, when they started taking place, which was a year and a half after the invasion had happened. So that's when they went onto a single track, because at that point in time, the delegation, Rwandan delegation at the peace talks, would have to come in with one voice to, or was expected to come in with one voice to negotiate with the Rwandan Patriotic Front.
So you identify three, by my count, three key kind of turning points, all of which are associated with this process of negotiation and conflict. And so I'll like to run through them one by one. One is the agreement in October of 1992, which you suggest started to reshape the way parties in Kigali understood what their purpose was and how they needed to act within Rwanda. So how did those early negotiations and why did those early negotiations in Arusha make such a big difference in the way people in Kigali thought?
Well, I think that when they went into peace negotiations in July of 1962, after, as I say, there had been a coalition government, multi-party government formed in Rwanda. They had tried to have peace talks earlier than that, but it would never work. And the difference was that with that coalition government came a prime minister from the opposition Hutu party, political party, and a prime minister and also a foreign minister, so that the whole tone and temper of negotiations changed. And so the new foreign minister had discussed directly with the RPF, which had never happened before. They had direct talks, but the government had maintained that they should be talking to the Ugandans rather than to the RPF. Mm. So now we were seeing the actual Tutsi RPF having its own voice and coming into these negotiations. And the first thing that they did was to set up a ceasefire. And the second thing that they did was to outline some principles that they would abide by during the course of the negotiations. And the third thing got right down to the sharing of political power. Well, now this was probably not what the people in the Kigali thought was going to happen anyway. So here they were talking about power sharing, and they hadn't allowed very much time for it. They thought they could do it in about a month in September, but by the end of October, they did it was sort of a preliminary protocol on power sharing. But the way the negotiators in Arusha looked at it, the protocols were almost law. They were a sign of agreement between the two parties, and they were laying down the groundwork for how how Rwanda would go about getting to multi-party elections. So by the end of October, they weren't finished with the negotiations, but the two sides, the government side headed by the opposition foreign minister and the person from Rwanda who was the head of the RPF, who by chance happened to be a Hutu, who had fallen out of favor with the president a long time earlier, much earlier, they had made an agreement that, in essence, would diminish the powers of the president. It would turn the president into more of a figurehead than into a person who was intimately involved in the governing of the country. Well, this got back to Rwanda, to Kigali, there was outrage. That was at the end of October, and November was a very, very difficult month. Mm-hmm. It's when two different speeches that I do also highlight in the book, mm-hmm. One by the president himself, the first one was by the political operative who talked about sending the Tutsi up the river back to where they came from. There was always this mythology that they had come from Ethiopia, so this was going to send them back to Ethiopia, where they came from, and that the whole thing was the whole metaphor was a euphemism for killing the Tutsi and getting rid of them. So that was pretty strong language. In the same month, the president gave a talk, national, and that one was not even, that was not a broadcast speech. That was a speech that just, once it had been, the words had been stated, it just flew around the country and everybody knew what had been said. The president spoke to the nation and he called the peace talks, the peace accord, referring to this protocol that had been signed by the two parties at Arusha, a chiffon de papier, a scrap of paper, and just sort of dismissing the peace talks out of hand. And so it was a very difficult time. The peace talks nearly collapsed, I learned later from the prime minister, who was from a opposition party and working closely with the foreign minister who was at the talks. And they said that he had to work very hard to keep the president engaged in the peace talks at that point. The president was convinced that that should be the end of it, that there was just nothing more to be said and nothing more to be gained by proceeding on.
One of the things you point out is that while there had been violence in Rwanda for most or all of the time you were there, that this violence really accelerated in the aftermath of this agreement, and especially in January of 1993. What did it feel like if to somebody who lived in Rwanda? How visible was that violence, and how much did you notice it, and how much did it impact the way you or other people in Rwanda lived their lives?
Well, you mentioned January of 1993, and I mentioned that the protocol in October that we were just talking about was an interim mm-hmm. protocol about peace, about power sharing. Well, by January 1993, the people in Arusha, the negotiators in Arusha, had signed a final protocol for power sharing, which they had agreed upon at the end of December without the concurrence of the political class in Rwanda. I mean, in Kigali. In Kigali, the political parties who were always worked together, most of the opposition political parties worked, by and large, together to increase their force against the president and his party, which was very dominant in Rwanda and in Kigali, where it wasn't so dominant in Arusha. But the people in Arusha had made the agreement without these preempting an agreement in the capital. And the people in the capital were just scathing about that. They were just really, I mean, if they were upset about the first one, this one was a factor of at least 10 times. It could have been much more than that. More angry. And violence was spreading throughout the northern part of the country, which is during this, once this the announcement was made that they'd made an agreement that the president's political party and the more hardline people in his party were just totally against. And you ask what happened? Well, they had what people knew, the hardline CDR party, which had spun off from the president's party, but was still working at this time, working with them, made a communique that I think it was broadcast on New Year's Eve about how this was just totally unacceptable. And they had a march, I think, in that time frame, still in December. After it was signed, that protocol was signed in early January, January 9th, there was just an escalation, a march in Kigali, thousands of people, that turned violent, and at least two people were killed in the course of that march, which included lots of tires being burned to make barricades and then burning the tires. And everybody was hunkered down. And the one of the killings actually took place very close to the Peace Corps office and to the USAID office, and not far from, within a mile or so from the embassy. So we were very affected by that. Our community had already been sensitized to the march, what was going on. And we had, in fact, just before the peace, because there was some escalation of violence in the center of Kigali just before the peace talks began, when they were still being talked, they had agreed to have them. They hadn't yet started. And so from that time, which was the end of May of 1992, we were holding briefings for the embassy community every couple of weeks. And so we were trying to keep them informed, but of course we couldn't always be ahead of the events. And so this was one that was extremely well known to our community. And this was one that really concerned everybody. There was a little bit of a lull because a human rights organization came in to do an investigation at about the middle of January. And that calmed things down for a bit. But as soon as they left, the violence continued in the northern part of the country. So people did know about it. It did affect us. Our world was getting smaller and smaller because there was a lot of random violence going on. And by this, I mean landmines were laid on roads and could explode under if a truck hit them or something. There were bombs going off in transportation, bus transportation, which was used mostly by Rwandans, except for our Peace Corps volunteers, who, if they came into the capital, would have to use this kind of transportation. So that worried the community. And I used to go out to restaurants a lot. And we just had to stop going to restaurants because one of the ones that I frequented, a bomb went off underneath somebody's table. I wasn't there at that time, thank goodness. One of the nightclubs that some of us used to go to, there was a bomb that went off there. Small ones, they weren't being too damaging, but they were there and they were giving everybody a sense of insecurity.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time, the Roast of Tom Brady. a Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart, the seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
There are at least a couple of reports that you cite by human rights organizations which at least invoke the word genocide, although they do not, in your account, kind of view this as an appropriate label for this. But is that even in your mind at that time, that this violence might become more than political or sporadic and might be genocidal? Or is that just something that didn't even enter your mind?
Well, I have to confess, and I'm not proud of it, that I personally was not thinking in terms of genocide. And this is despite the fact that there were any number of massacres that were going on around throughout this period of time, right after the RPF invaded. Way back in October of 1990, there were massacres in the northern part of the country. There were when they always happened when there were some steps toward democratization or peace. So when the government formed its just before they announced the formation of the multi-party government in March of 1992, there was a massacres to the south of Kigali. Then after they started the talks, the peace talks in Arusha, and were going to start to have the power sharing talks, there were massacres in a town called in a town that's by the lake. It was near not too far from the capital, but it took a long time to get there the way the roads were. So there were these mini massacres all over the country at different periods of time, usually 300 killed and 1500 or so could have been displaced people. But somehow for me, I didn't see that as escalating to a unified concerted effort to destroy an entire group of people, which is required by the Genocide Convention to determine whether it's a genocide. And also human rights people who looked at it afterwards, who looked at it and whose reports came much too late, but they were unwilling to come out and declare that it was a genocide or declare that it met the terms of the Genocide Convention, the International Genocide Convention. They would say that it looked like it could or it might or it, you know, there were elements, so on and so forth. So, yeah, it's unfortunate that we didn't think of it as that. We might have taken a different policy. And I feel that this is what partly my book is aimed at doing, is trying to focus on the fact that we really needed to do more than just promote and support democracy and peace. We had to look at the unintended consequences of the promotion of genocide and peace, because every time there were, as I say, advances, there was increased violence, so that there was no amount of better promotion, better democratization that was going to help, because these people were trying to undermine it. The violence was definitely intended to undermine the peace and the democratization efforts in the country. And so I think this is why I advocate prevention and better training, better understanding of early warning signs, and so that that in future, people who are engaged in this kind of conflict, these kinds of conflict situations, will be ready for something like this and be much more alert to doing preventive diplomacy, to doing peace building activities. These words weren't in our lexicon back in the early 90s, quite honestly, but we need to have a lot more training and sensitivity so that another time people would not be as naive or as single-minded as we were and not think in terms of the possibility of a genocide and what kinds of diplomatic activities could we engage in that would help to dissuade the people from it. We were trying to dissuade them from conflict, but we weren't. We were doing it by encouraging them to hurry up and do the and you know, to negotiate your democracy, negotiate your peace. So we needed to have a second track.
Another turning point you point to is the February 1993 offensive of the RPF. Why was that so important?
In February 1993, which was at the end of the January from hell, as I call it, where the peace accord, I mean, where the in Arusha, the two sides had signed the power sharing protocol, which the hardliners in Kigali totally rejected because they said it. At the end of that month, or February 8th, beginning of February, the negotiators had gone back to Arusha. Some of us diplomats had gone into one of the areas where some of the violence had been the worst, and to see what the situation was. It was just on the heels of that that the RPF started to move down from its base, which was by this time inside Rwanda. And since Rwanda's a very small country, let me remind you, it's not much bigger than Delaware. But 40 miles away at the border was a long way. And so they started moving down from their base, which was near the border. And we would be able to hear exploding ordnance at nighttime, daytime. Anyway, they seemed like they were wanting to capture Kigali, which they never did. But the offensive seemed to me to be a big mistake because they were, because the effect was to really anger the Hutu in the opposition parties who had agreed and who were supporting power sharing, who were saying, these people belong in our country. We've got to, you know, we have Hutu, we have Tutsi in our country. You know, we need to make peace with these folks. We need to have them in our government. We need to share power. But now all of that was being called into question. Why? And not only was it angering the people who already weren't very happy about sharing power, but it seemed to convince those who had agreed to share power to back away from that agreement. Mm-hmm. So here we were the situation was where the president and his party were scathingly about this breaking the ceasefire, moving towards Kigali. And the government forces weren't able to stop them. They needed to call in the French. And so it just was, in my view, a provocation that was counterproductive to what they were trying to achieve. When asked why they broke the peace accord of 6 months for this offensive, they said it was a retaliation for all of the violence that had been perpetrated against Tutsi during the month of December and January. And there had been a lot, but it was against Hutu as well. It was violence. It was a lot of violence that the government forces and the militia that were beginning to be active, former political party youth group that were being active as militia. So it just seemed to me to be very counterproductive. It wasn't until much longer after when I had a chance to talk with some people who were in the Rwandan government at the time, who suggested that maybe that wasn't so anodyne their reasons for breaking the ceasefire and going on this offensive, that it really seemed to them that what they were actually trying to do was to divide the Hutu within the country, to divide the political party, to weaken the political parties within the country. And when I looked at it from that perspective, I would say that was a very likely scenario, because that was the point at which the opposition political parties began to realign with the Hutu in power, who were opposed to power sharing. And after that, it seemed like any Hutu that was still supporting power sharing was going to become an enemy of the people, who was going to be labeled as a traitor to the Hutu cause. It built up and built up. But it was the beginning there where they were laying the groundwork of a realigned Hutu community was laid. And the provocation of the offensive was what they could point to and say, that was where we lost all faith in in sharing power. We just didn't trust, we couldn't trust them anymore. We couldn't trust the Tutsi anymore.
You comment in your section on the continued and the ends of the Arusha negotiations that the Tutsi, the RPF goal was different than that of the government, in a particular way, that the Tutsis wanted to revolutionarily reconstruct politics in Rwanda. The government was willing to accept evolutionary change, but not revolutionary change. So I wonder first, quickly, you were an observer for part of the Arusha talks, so maybe you could say a little bit about what they looked like and felt like, and then talk about what role that Arusha agreement played in the run-up toward the eventual genocide.
Well, evolution versus revolution. It seemed to me that the sense that we were in the early days that I was there, and in the whole first couple of years that I was there, that the people inside Rwanda, once the RPF was a factor, were thinking, well, that they would just join. RPF would become a political party and would compete as any other. Would compete like the opposition parties would have to compete. But this would give the president's party an advantage, because it had been running a one-party state for nearly 20 years. And what is maybe people in our government, in our country, don't understand what a one-party state would mean. But what it means is that the political party in question controls everything. Not only in the government, not only the forces of security, the army, the police, but also the administration from top to bottom. They're the governors of all the states. They're the mayors of all the cities. They run all of the local party groups. So that from top to bottom, it's run by the party. Well, in Rwanda, gradually, as the multi-party government was in charge, they were having to diversify leadership in terms of governorships and various parts of the country, the mayors of the cities, the so on and so forth. They were diversifying so that other people from other political parties were getting into these positions. But they still didn't think of themselves as having very, you know, it was more going to be evolutionary. It would happen little by little. But in the way that the peace accord was structured, the minority Tutsi were going to have a role in the government, who were the ministers, and in the legislative assembly, equal to that of the president's party. This was going to be to signal extreme changes. And this is what upset the president and his party so much, is that they did not think that the RPF should be given equal footing to them, which made the Hutu opposition parties in the structure of the next government that was going to set up what the future is going to be, this transition. They were heading to a transitional government, but they were saying that that was going to have to they would have to share this power, and the opposition parties would be the balance of power. That if they were on the RPF side, then the RPF would be able to control everything. If they were on the president's side, then the president would be able to control everything. But when the peace accord was signed, it absolutely looked like the Hutu opposition parties, who had sided with the RPF in many of the decisions at Arusha, would be behind them, and would, so the president would, as some of his supporters said, the president's party would become a minority party. So that's the difference between evolution and revolution, which would really turn everything upside down inside Rwanda. It wasn't going to be a slow change of power relationships. It was going to be an abrupt change of power relationships that many in the president's party and increasingly among the Hutu who were in the opposition were not ready to accept. So what did Arusha look like? You wanted me to ask what
Please.
Did Arusha look like?
Yeah, what did it feel like to be there?
Well, it was it was very interesting to be there, and I tried to describe in the book what it felt like to be an observer. Where the RPF side was extremely disciplined and extremely united, And the president's, the government side, spanned the gamut from hardliners who were actually to the right of the president in terms of their thinking about how there should be no fraternizing with the RPF at all or sharing power, and those who were, and then there was even one Tutsi minister going all the way to the other end of the spectrum. Not to say that the Tutsi minister was always on the same page as the Tutsi in the RPF, but that was the sort of gamut on the delegation of the government. And trying to get them on the same page, we would say, was like herding cats, because it was very, they were, as I've said in the book, and there was no common vision among the parties who were struggling, vying for power, about what the future of Rwanda should look like. The RPF had its vision. The Hutu who had been in the running the government had their vision. The Hutu opposition had its vision. And so here was I describe it as almost a three-sided negotiating table, where you had the Hutu in the government, from the government on one side, the Hutu opposition party people on another side, and the RPF on another. And it was kind of like, on any one day, who would side with who? And who to determine who would prevail. So it was, and in many cases, the Hutu opposition, led by the foreign minister, would make common cause. I wouldn't say they trusted or they agreed with they trusted the RPF, but they would make common cause with them because it would advance both of their interests vis-a-vis the president and his party. Much of the time at Arusha was spent with the two sides, the government and the RPF, in their own negotiations among themselves about what their positions would be and what they were talking about at that time, whether it was about disarmament or whether it was about merging the armies, or when I was there, it was on the military talks. And so they would be working alone. I would be writing reports or getting to know the observers from the African or the Western countries or the UN people who were there. When they decided that they had something, and the facilitator, who was the Tanzanians, who had been named in the going into the peace talks as the facilitator for the talks, they would be having private conversations with the two sides or with us, the diplomatic observers, and we would all be trying to work with them to find compromises so they could move forward. And in the book, I do contrast this with what was going on in Kigali, because the diplomats in Kigali were working only with the Hutu side, trying to get them to forge agreements among themselves to take to Arusha. And we in Arusha were then trying to get those, what was coming from the country to that to the government delegation, to get them to harmonize their interests with the RPF. So there was a slightly different role for us in Arusha than from the diplomats in Kigali. So what was the role of Arusha in the genocide?
So
is that your question?
Let me rephrase. Once Arusha is signed, Did you feel hopeful? Did you think that that Rwanda was on a path to peace, or were you pessimistic that these accords would work?
Well, that's an interesting way of asking me what I was feeling, because I never quite looked at it that way. We were hopeful. Let me put it this way. Our ambassador, we were hopeful throughout that it was all going to come to a successful conclusion. This is part of the problem as well. Just like we weren't thinking about genocide, we weren't necessarily thinking of failure. But when Arusha, after Arusha was signed, I note in the book that there was absolute silence from Kigali after they were signed. The president was there to sign them. The president of the RPF was there to sign them. The signing took place in Arusha, and the prime minister. On August 4th, 1993, I was in Kigali, there was nothing at all to suggest that anything was different from one day to the next. Finally, the prime minister had to declare a day to celebrate the Arusha success. Hmm. People in Rwanda were just like, they were just on pins and needles, really. They were like, this isn't going to work. This is just, you know, it's just, they're not being serious. It's not going to happen. I think in a way they're pessimists by culture, but there was just no exuberance, very little exuberance that this was actually going to work. Well, and I did write a cable, which has now been declassified, that did lay out the fact that the security situation was just still a big problem, and the extent to which people, various parties were really willing and ready to abide by the terms of the agreement just wasn't clear. But people came back, got back to work, and there was a lot of activity leading up towards the implementation of the accords. But it just seemed like the genocide began 6-8 months later. During those 8 months, things got worse and worse and worse. But, you know, it was always like, there's got to be a way out of this. There's got to be an exit. There's got to be an off ramp somewhere, and the off ramp kind of never came. But there was a lot of energy, much of which was in the international community, that things were going to work. And this comes back to another thing that I say is, we can never want it more than the people who are fighting. We, the diplomats, we can't want it more than the parties themselves do. And I think we got out a little bit ahead of where the parties themselves were. But there was one thing after another that was put in front of the parties put in front of themselves that kept implementation from taking place, one after another. First, the parties were splitting and falling apart. They couldn't come up with common lists of people to be in the government or people to be in the parliament. They couldn't come up with, they weren't ready to accept the divisions, because the whole peace accord rested on the unity of the parties. And if one group said, okay, we're going to split from that group that we can't agree with anymore, then they would be out, lost. They would no longer have a role in the implementation, because the parties were named that were going to be participants in the government. They were named in the peace accord. Their hands were tied. They had to stick together and try to find a way through it. And then it was After that, it was the role of the CDR. I mentioned earlier it was the hardline party, and by this time they had totally split from the president, and they were on their own, and they were not accepting the, they had refused to sign the peace accords, and they were, as all the other parties did. So there was a lot of and then of course the international peacekeeping force arrives in Rwanda, and it too becomes a victim of the denigration campaign that by the private radio RTLM, and so they were undermining the role of the UN as a peacekeeping force. So there were just a lot of things that were militating against success, but we were still fighting for success, even though it was looking less and less likely. I had to put in my bid to the State Department for my next position, because I was supposed to leave anyway in the summer of 1964, but and I said, maybe I should stick around and find how the story ends. Well, I don't think it's ended quite yet, but we'll see.
So that's actually was going to be my last substantive question was, and let me pause by saying there's lots more in the book than we've had time to get to, and I encourage people to go out and read it. It's a wonderful story, and in particular, it's got a lot of important insights into ways that things that we can learn from the lessons of Rwanda and other places in trying to prevent this in the future. But I wonder, I know that you went back shortly after the genocide was over. I wonder if you've been back to Rwanda in the years since, and what it feels like to you to go back to this place that you spent so much time in when it was on the verge of collapse.
It's interesting that you should ask. I did have a chapter in the book that came out that has to do with going back.
Yeah.
After all of this happened, well, I did that chapter's in there, the one about, but much later when I did go back. But I went back right after, and that was one of the hardest assignments that I ever had. I went back for 2 weeks to kind of hold down the fort before the ambassador came back. And they wanted the embassy opened a little prematurely because there was a cholera epidemic in one of the refugee camps when the RPF stopped the genocide and chased the government forces out of the country. A lot of civilians followed, and they were in camps just across the border in Zaire, and they were having cholera. So we sent some military out to help straighten out the camps clear them of cholera if possible. Anyway, so I was back there for 2 weeks, and it was really, really very hard because so many people had fled, and new ones were taking their place who were refugees, Tutsi refugees coming back, mostly from Burundi. I saw a lot of Burundi license plates, but you didn't see a lot of physical damage in Kigali itself, but there were no telephones that worked. There electricity worked, but I don't know if we had it all the time. Made water sort of rationed as well. It was hard living, and it was hard to do your job because you couldn't pick up a telephone and call anybody to set up an appointment. And so people were going around town leaving messages about wanting appointment with so-and-so. And it was extremely laborious kind of way of operating. But so I went back then, and it was hard. But then I went back, what is it, 10 years later? Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was about 10 years after the genocide. I was working with the State Department on having retired already, but I was working with them on an initiative for the region to talk to each other and to work out common solutions to common security problems. And when I went back that time, I was very, it was just hard. Everybody I met who I knew needed to tell me their story. And I had a lot of, listening to do and hearing a lot of difficult stories. Some of them were rather heroic, but also still difficult to hear. But things were, you know, Rwanda is a country that has really recovered economically from the genocide, but there's still a lot of discrimination going on, I think, and it is still a place where they're struggling to balance security with diplomatic freedoms.
Well, that seems an appropriate place to end. You've been very generous with your time. Thank you so much. I always ask guests, though, as the last thing they do for the show, I wonder if you could suggest to listeners a book or a movie or something that they can read or hear or watch that was meaningful to you somehow in terms of making this book. What should my listeners read this weekend?
Well, I did listen to your previous interviews, and I realized that this was going to be a question. So I have a little list here.
Excellent.
Excuse me. I think something that people could listen to, could watch for, that really moved me, was something that I saw when I. When would it have been? About 2009. There's a play, a theater play, called Ruined, R-U-I-N-E-D, Ruined, and it's by a writer called Lynn Nottage, N-O-T. I think it's two T's, A-G-E, Lynn Nottage, and it hasn't made the big time. She has done some other plays that have gone farther. That I was in London and saw her in the headlights in the theater district lights.
Uh-huh.
Saw her name up there for a different play. But anyway, it's really about the what was going on in which is part of the legacy of the genocide. The fighting and that's going on still today across the border in what was Zaire, now the Democratic mm-hmm. Republic of the Congo. But it's a very powerful play. Of course, there are all the popular movies, Hotel Rwanda, mm-hmm. which many of the people in Rwanda feel has not done justice to the story, but I believe is a very good introduction to people who would like to know what kinds of issues people were struggling with in that very early part of the genocide, leading up to it, and in the early part of the genocide. and it is a more popularized way of looking at it, but I think that it gives us, the Western viewer, a lot of insight into the kind of thinking that was going on. And I think that, there's just several books that I used as resources. I don't know if that's the kind of thing that were resources to me, because most of it I wrote out of my, you know, most of my memories, most of what I've recalling, but sometimes I needed to get some names or certain sequences, and there's of course the Human Rights Watch Alison DeForge wrote Leave None to Tell the Story. It's a huge book that it's hard would be hard to read front to back.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a lot of good stuff in it. And then several books that have chapters on Rwanda. Another one about the genocide legacy is Jason Stern's Dancing with Monsters.
Mm-hmm.
Because after the genocide, to get Rwandan government, the Tutsi government that took over twice, entered into the Congo to try to first get back people, that their civilians, to get them back into Rwanda, and then also to try to eliminate the threat of the former Rwandan army that still existed in the Congo. And that was, so those are just a few. There's one called Aiding Violence by Peter Yuvin. That's more of from an aid perspective. I was going to look up there's a book called Neighbors Killing Neighbors, which is a gal that wrote it as a dissertation, transformed dissertation. And I was going to look her name up, but just the Neighbors Killing Neighbors. It gives you a very interesting insight into the thinking of the people who were on the front lines of killing during the genocide.
I believe her name is Leanne Fuji, and I know that because I think she was the second or third interview I ever did on this show. So I appreciate that reminder. And I agree, that's a wonderful book.
It's a very good book.
The play sounds really interesting. You've now distracted me from supervising my children's homework, which I am in theory doing this during the pandemic shutdown. And I instead will go read the script, which sounds wonderful. But thank you so much for your time. I very much appreciate it. And I know listeners do too. And as I suggested, I think the book is well worth reading and well worth looking for. We've been talking to the Ambassador Joyce Leader with the book about her book From Hope to Horror, Diplomacy and the Making of the Rwandan Genocide. And I hope, listeners, you'll join me next time when I'll be speaking to John Roth again as he returns to the show to talk about his mentors and his teachers and his friends who have helped him think about philosophy and mass atrocities. So until then, I wish you a happy shutdown. And thank you again, Ambassador.
Thank you for the opportunity.